We don't really rock on our own. It's just not as fun. So
this is Solidarity Journal. Share in a common voice. Just might find your own.
To think that this was John Doe.
It's like the argument about the arguments in part. No, we fought an entire goddamn war. States' right to do what?
You will not be able to stay home, brother. You will not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out. You will not be able to lose yourself on Skag and skip out for beer during commercials because the revolution...
It's Tuesday, October 25th, and you're listening to Solidarity Journal on WAZU 90.7 FM, Peoria's one and only Pacifica radio affiliate. I'm your host, Michael Perillo. On today's show, interviews on the Occupy movements in Normal and Peoria, Illinois, listening in on the General Assemblies to find out what's being decided through consensus and where the movement is heading. Also, featured music by Eric Ayo, a speech that Noam Chomsky gave at Occupy Boston, and the indigenous perspective of the Occupy movements. So stay tuned to Solidarity Journal on the front lines of radio resistance. Listening to Solidarity Journal on WAZU 90.7 FM, Peoria's one and only Pacifica radio affiliate. I am your host, Michael Perillo. Occupy Peoria had their second general assembly this past Saturday on the riverfront. After the previous Saturday's rally, march, and general assembly, there was a lot of work to be done. Deciding where to meet and demonstrate to get the word out and to be recognized was on the agenda. Occupation was also on a lot of people's minds. There was concern about not having made any decision on what our stated goals were, which worried some, but while others find that those will eventually come when Occupy Peoria becomes more established.
I think this group of people right now is too small to make a decision like that, and I think a lot of people have different ideas about it, but as we come here and not really know what the exact goal is, we're finding more and more overlap. So I think it's premature to make a statement of goals. That's my opinion.
I think it's something we need to do, though. I'm tired of reading in the press that we don't have any goals.
You said you're tired of hearing about bad reports, bad press towards the group. If you're not getting bad press, you're doing it wrong, because the press is owned by the people we're complaining about. If they're saying you're doing a good job, you're probably not.
It was at this point someone spoke up on why this movement is unique when it doesn't have leaders or a list of goals. It focuses more on the discontent a lot of us in this country and around the world feel about our government and how the corporate sector, the financial institutions, bankers, and others have destroyed us, leaving many homeless, jobless, in debt, and a future that looks bleak, while the wars abroad murder and ruin lives of many more.
I'm sure, like me, you've tried to read as much as you can on the internet about the Occupy Wall Street movement, and the fact that it's not just Occupy Wall Street, but it's a worldwide movement. One of the key elements about it is that it is something different at this point. We are used to having reform movements, like the Civil Rights Movement, so on, that had a leader, that had specific goals that had been narrowed down. this movement is more a people's movement that embraces everything. No leaders, no restrictive goals, but a common unifying sentiment, maybe it would be a better term. And I think that's where this is. This, in my opinion, it appears this is something new and different. And that makes people uncomfortable when you don't have leaders and a list of goals. But I think the unifying sentiment that unifies people that maybe feel that there ought to be a more conservative, or people that feel that ought to be more liberal, some people feel there ought to be revolution, is a common sentiment that the people's needs and interests are what should be addressed, or what should direct our government that's supposed to be our servant. You know, and I think that that is what is unifying those of us that might disagree on a lot of minutiae of implementation, is that our freedoms are threatened. They are being diluted, being taken away. It doesn't take much of a farsight to see ultimately workers will have no rights. Ultimately, people will be thrown out of their houses. Ultimately, students, if they're able to get an education, will be a slave to paying back that debt. This all threatens our democracy. And we either rise up now and say, stop, I am not going to march down that road towards slavery. We've got to do it now, or it's too late later on.
The Bradley Action Committee, who has been getting other students at Bradley active on political issues, but mostly to get involved with Occupy Peoria, gave their report on what has been going on at Bradley. It's well known that, although apathy is very present within Peoria and in this country, the Bradley University has never been strong in activism.
To be honest, Bradley, I know, like you guys already know, is pretty apathetic, and it's going to be a long struggle to get people to even care. A few people walk by, you know, you'd ask, you want to know more about the Occupy movement, they kind of just, like, chuckle and walk away. So, and I asked of everyone to trust the Bradley students that we are not trying to separate from you guys, that seriously, there is really bad apathy at Bradley, and if we don't have a focus group on Bradley, then we will not get more students here.
The last comment that was made by the Bradley Action Committee came from a lot of previous discussions and arguments on Occupy Peoria splintering in the past due to all the different ideologies coming together for the first time.
One of the things, historically speaking, you have to be careful of is that the groups, the larger protest group, doesn't fragment into, we've got the students, we've got the townies, we've got the labor unions, we've got this and that, and yeah, we're kind of together, but we don't really trust each other, we don't really communicate. I think the strength is recognizing we're all in this together. And so so we want to be careful. We don't have this group there and that group there. And before long, you know, we're not united.
Someone else brought up that Occupy Peoria should consider buying a foreclosed home, fixing it up, and then using it for a headquarters for future actions.
All week I've been kind of talking to some people and investigating things and researching stuff about what would happen if we tried to occupy a foreclosed house. I heard from some people who would actually be involved in doing actually the actual occupying, and they kind of like the idea of having a roof and windows. So that was the direction that I went into looking at. I talked to one real estate friend of mine. So I mean, I by no means do I have a concise, complete idea of what all's going on, but he directed me to the HUD website where I could search for foreclosed homes in our area. He suggested that we not try to occupy any place illegally, because if that were the case, we would not be able to draw attention to ourselves. Anybody could call the police and we'd be out of there.
In terms of an occupation, an actual occupation of something, I would think that one of the reasons that you have such an occupation is to demonstrate that we are the public, we represent the public, and that we can exercise our First Amendment rights on public property.
That's right.
So it's an interesting concept, but
I don't see why we couldn't do both.
Well, no, I don't either, but I think if we're talking about an occupation, that we're talking about occupying public space and speaking for the public.
Not everyone at this assembly was from Peoria.
One individual came from Bloomington Normal to show his support for Occupy Peoria and to tell us how Occupy Blono had been doing.
I'm from the Bloomington Normal occupation. We've been living outside for 2 weeks now. We've organized consensuses, we've planned marches, and
I had gone to Bloomington Normal the night before and met with those occupying on campus. Occupy Blono has been ahead of the ball with already having gotten a lot of press in the past with their demonstrations and an occupation.
Walking or driving along College Avenue in Normal, Illinois, they are hard to miss. A crowd of students that belong to a group known as Occupy Blono. You may think this group is unorganized, but they're not. They follow very specific rules.
I decided to meet the group in person and see how their occupation was coming along. It was a cold Friday night when I arrived there, and I was already late for the General Assembly for Occupy Blono as I hiked up the steps at the Bone Student Center. The occupation is located in between the Bone Student Center and Milner Library, just right off of College Avenue. There's one tent that's already set up. Sleeping bags are strewn across the pavement, along with air mattresses, pillows, blankets. Miniature coolers are parked by a donated food table with crock pots, water jugs, and other supplies. A man types away at his laptop working on his college thesis paper for his master's while helping out with the occupation. Off to the side of him is a tarp that has been tied up to block wind, and on the other side of that tarp is where some of the occupiers are making black armbands that say Occupy Blono. These are the many items of an enduring occupation and community at work. It has been over a week now since Occupy Blono has been sustaining a 24/7 occupation. This after the country and the world has been doing their own occupations, marches, and rallies, mirroring Occupy Wall Street, which started back on September 17th. When I make my way towards the General Assembly, I find a group of 22 people in a circle discussing future actions for Occupy Blono through a consensus. People are lighting up cigs, eating bread, huddled together and bundled up, while taking notes of what's being said on each agenda. Surrounding the occupied area are signs that have been handwritten from parts of the Occupy Wall Street Declaration. These statements say how the lives of people in this country and everywhere else around the world have been exploited, ruined, and destroyed by those in power. The General Assembly has been an important part of the Occupy movements that have been springing up across the world. They come not only from Occupy Wall Street, but the mass protests in Madrid, and even further back to indigenous Afro-Colombian tribes, for example, would use a consensus, even in regional councils that would make up 50 communities. The occupation was by the bridge, for it's a high visibility, and that students would be able to devote their time to this spot easily, since it would be right there on campus. But then it moved due to rain, which brought them to the new site by Milner Library. But the problem is that this makes it look like a student-only movement, since it's deeper into the campus. But those occupying want the community to know that they're more than welcome to get involved.
Maybe you support the idea of looking at this as an outreach opportunity, so that we're opening this up. We're saying we don't want this to only be an ISU student thing. We'd like IWU students, alumni, faculty, staff to be involved, so we're trying to bring new people in.
There was a lot of discussion on what to do at their upcoming demonstration to bring awareness of Occupy Blono and why it is they're occupying part of the campus in the first place.
The idea, we're not actually doing a protest, we're demonstrating who we are by going there and having that Occupy thing. Having the dollars taped to our mouth is a visual understanding of what is that. You wonder what that is.
But I think that part of a silent action like that is that it's powerful if a lot of people are doing it. If you just got one person with a dollar in their mouth, it just looks like crazy. But if it's a lot of us, then it has kind of a more powerful effect.
The money over your mouth is, you have no voice. Their money has spoken for you.
The Occupy Blono movement has made its presence known at Illinois State. Now the group is taking its message to Illinois Wesleyan.
At the demonstration to raise awareness, people of Occupy Blono made their appearance to spread the word on what they were doing and why, but were eventually told by IW security that they were going to be arrested if they didn't leave the property. But unlike those who would want to shut down their right to peacefully assemble, one person in the General Assembly that night brought up a great point about the Occupy Wall Street and all the other occupations that are happening.
There are quite a few people in the Occupy Wall Street movement that are focusing the movement on a basis of compassion. for all people. Going into it not with focusing on debt, you know, these are kind of like symptoms of the problem that we are not showing compassion to our fellow man. And I feel like if we go into Wesleyan campus with the attitude of we're here to promote compassion for all people, and the way we do that is we try to, you know, deal with these issues of student loans and with the issues of people being, you know, impoverished and the reasons behind it and Wall Street getting tied in with the politics of it, like, that it stems from that one place. And if you go into it with a feeling of love and a feeling of inclusion, people are going to naturally going to be drawn to you, you know, so you don't have to worry as much about making a huge statement. But that's just my perspective, and I feel like maybe that hasn't been brought up as much within the group, and that would be a good thing to have that more positive feelings. It's hard to recruit people to any organization that is based on fear or on anger. People aren't going to be attracted to that. They want to come to a place where they feel nurtured and comforted and accepted and supported.
This was further realized by one of the occupiers, Kelsey Bremner, who happened to be at the Wall Street occupation not too long ago and witnessed this solidarity and compassion taking place.
Because of the amount of people that were there, it made me realize like how well people can come together and work together, and just how like friendly and open everyone was.
What she felt in New York City is the same compassion she felt at Occupy Bologna, which kept her coming back and sticking it out.
The movement itself, obviously, and I mean it brings everybody up here, but then once you get up here and you're up here with all the occupiers and all the community members that come by and do what they can for you, like, it's that energy and that spirit that I see in everyone, that like it's just such a good feeling.
This comradeship is normal. When one eats, sleeps, and works together, a relationship grows. But trying to get more people in the community together has been difficult, as Jennifer Carrillo explained to me.
And as far as the students, I think unfortunately a lot of them just don't know what's going on, which is unfortunate, but I feel like that's why we're here. We're here to help and educate and promote, like, people taking it upon themselves to investigate these things that are happening all around us, because this is big, you know, this is big for our generation. And I think, of course, we've been met with resistance, but I think to us that only shows that we're doing something right, that we're pushing people's buttons, that we're making them think, and that's the whole point.
I also asked her what Occupy Bologna has been doing to reach out to those in their community who are marginalized and are demonized by our society because of their race.
Definitely. I actually just brought up this conversation about immigrants. One of the things that I was doing before occupying was working with immigrant right groups in the community, and I feel like that's one very, very ignored segment of society that is, because of corporations and the government teaming up they've created these conditions where we essentially have it's slavery. I mean, it's modern day slavery, because these people can't demand any rights, and we know that they're here, and we demonize them constantly in the media and in all sorts of contexts, but they can't do anything about it because they're not citizens, they have no rights, and they can't demand things the same way that we do. So I feel like that's especially a population that we need to be speaking out for, because we can't.
At one point, a local restaurant brought free food to the occupiers. Dan Garrison has been bringing them food throughout the occupation and appreciates what they have been doing.
I appreciate the intestinal fortitude it takes to camp out here in the cold. I've been banging on this anarchist drum for about 20 years now, and it's nice to see some people actually stand up for the fact that we're being disenfranchised and taken advantage of. It's important.
After everyone had their fair share of food and started to unwind from the day, I spoke to a woman named Amelia Hill on what brought her to occupy the campus area and how she wants to help out the community in Bloomington Normal.
Well, I was a sociology major. I recently graduated, and the disparities are something that I just became acutely aware of throughout my studies, and how our political system just doesn't address our needs. And it's not it's not good for the majority of our people. So I've been frustrated with this for a long time, and when this started up, I was really excited to see that there was momentum here in our community. You know, from a personal perspective, having graduated and, you know, I have a degree in sociology, I would like to do something very productive with where I'm helping the community. But since, you know, there's been government cuts, there's been, you know, nonprofit jobs are not that easy to find. And it puts you in the position of, well, you might just have to go work at McDonald's or for Sears. And that's something that goes against what I believe in. So to be put in that position kind of makes it real that we are living in a system where I have to make huge compromises with my life that I wouldn't like to make. So we'd like to even out the wealth and power in our society and try to work towards a better way of doing things.
They're hoping to look at not only the national grievances that the Occupy Wall Street Declaration addresses, but those in their community as well, like the frustrations with local banks that foreclosed a lot of the homes in the Bloomington Normal community. But one thing Amelia wants to let others know, especially in the media, is that they're sincere about what they are fighting for, and want to let everyone know that this is more about the problems we face today, and not just about them.
Sometimes they take the approach that this is kind of, I don't know, like a cute thing for us to be doing, and it's not, we're not out here to be cute, we're not out here just because we support a cause, we're trying to create change, and this is a very serious thing for us. We take direct democracy seriously, and we're trying to learn how to do it so that we ourselves can take the power back.
To stop it, I did nothing. When the wind was changing, I was sleeping, thinking only of myself, thinking of me. And I wish there were more like Babe Austin, or more like Elaine Brown, or the folks who stood at Warner Creek and risk their lives. But I'm not like them, I'm just a coward in human clothes, and I can't pretend that I'm doing all I can. But I've never walked one day in your shoes. Now we've got a large presence to fill here, from all of those that for us. But lately I've been feeling as though we've thrown dirt over that pie, and we've neglected to come back those.
Thanks for tuning in to Solidarity Journal on WAZU 90.7 FM, Peoria's one and only Pacifica radio affiliate. Now on October 22nd at Occupy Boston, Noam Chomsky made an appearance to speak to the protesters. We'll have audio of that courtesy of New Zealand Radio Chomsky. Also, we'll have an indigenous perspective of the Occupy movement, which from their point of view has been happening for about 500 years now. But first, here's Noam Chomsky's speech at Occupy Boston. One day in your shoes.
Question always is, can you hear me? Can you hear me in the back?
Close as possible.
How's that? Can you hear me in the back? Still not.
You're
suggestion?
Dude, you're killing me.
Can you,
sorry. How's this? Any different? How's that? Okay, well, I'll try to not eat it. Okay.
People can't see.
This is.
Yeah, you're both on.
Okay.
You're good.
Well, it's a little hard to talk at a give a talk in a Howard Zinn Memorial Lecture at a Occupy meeting. There's mixed feelings necessarily go along with it. Closer. First of all, regret that Howard's not here to take part in and invigorate in his inimitable way something that would have been the dream of his life. Secondly, excitement that the dream's actually being fulfilled. It's a dream that for which he laid a lot of the groundwork. As I said, it would have been a fulfillment of a dream for him to have been here with you. And it is a very exciting development. Okay. Well, why don't you take this? How about that? Well, it is an extremely exciting development. In fact, it's kind of spectacular and unprecedented. There's never been anything like it that I can think of. If the bonds and associations that are being established in these remarkable events can be sustained through a long, hard period ahead, because victories don't come quickly, it could turn out to be a really historic, a very significant moment in American history. The fact that the demonstrations are unprecedented, the Occupy movement is unprecedented, is quite appropriate. It's an unprecedented era, not just this moment, but actually since the 1970s. In the 1970s, there was began a major turning point in American history. Since the for centuries, since the country began, it had been a developing society, not in very pretty ways. That's another story. But it was a developing society with ups and downs, but the general progress towards wealth, industrialization, development, even in dark and hope, there was a lot of pretty near constant expectation that it's going to go on like this. That was true even in very dark times. I'm just old enough to remember the Great Depression. And after the first few years, by the mid-30s, although the situation was objectively much harsher than it is today, nevertheless, the spirit was quite different. There was a sense that we're going to get out of it, even among unemployed people, a lot of my relatives, that it'll get better. There's a militant labor movement organizing, CIO organizing is going on. It was getting to the point of sit-down strikes, which really are very frightening to the business world. You could see it in the business press at the time, because a sit-down strike is just a step before taking over the factory and running it yourself. And something which, incidentally, is very much on the agenda today, and we should keep in mind. I'll come back to it. Also, the New Deal legislations were beginning to come under popular pressure. And there just was a sense somehow we're going to get out of it. It's quite different now. Now there's a kind of pervasive sense of hopelessness, sometimes despair. I think it's quite new in American history, and it has an objective basis. in the 1930s, unemployed working people could anticipate realistically that the jobs are going to come back. If you're a worker in manufacturing today, and the level of unemployment in manufacturing is approximately like the Depression, if current tendencies persist, those jobs aren't going to come back. The change took place in the 70s. A lot of reasons for it. One of the underlying reasons, discussed mainly by economic historian Robert Brenner, done a lot of work on it, is the falling rate of profit. There were other factors. It led to major changes in the economy. A reversal of the several hundred years of progress towards industrialization and development, and turned to a process of deindustrialization and de-development. Of course, manufacturing production continued, but overseas. Very profitable, but no good for the workforce. And along with that came a significant shift of the economy from productive enterprise, producing things people need or could use, to financial manipulation. Financialization of the economy really took off at that time, before the 70s. Banks were banks. They did what banks are supposed to do in a state capitalist economy, take unused funds, like, say, your bank account, and transfer it to some potentially useful purpose, like buying a home, sending a kid to college, or whatever it might be. That changed radically. And incidentally, there were no financial crises. It was a period of enormous growth, the highest growth in American history, maybe in economic history, sustained growth through the 50s and the 60s, and it was egalitarian. So the lowest quintile did about as well as the highest quintile. A lot of people moved into reasonable lifestyles, what's called here middle class, working class, it's called in other countries. But they, that was real, and the 60s accelerated it. The activism in the 60s, after a pretty dismal decade, really civilized the country in lots of ways that are permanent. They're not changing. They're staying on. 70s came along, sudden sharp change, deindustrialization, offshoring of production, shifting to financial institutions, which grew enormously. I should say that in the 50s and the 60s, there was also the development of what several decades later became the high-tech economy. Computers, internet, IT revolution, mostly developed in the 50s and the 60s, substantially in the state sector. It took a couple of decades before it took off, but it was developed there. The 1970s, the developments that took place, set off a kind of a vicious cycle. It led to concentration of wealth, increasingly in the hands of the financial sector, which doesn't benefit the economy, probably harms it and the society. But it did lead to tremendous concentration of wealth, substantially there. Concentration of wealth yields concentration of political power, which in turn gives rise to legislation that increases, that accelerates the cycle of the fiscal policies, tax changes, rules of corporate governance, deregulation, essentially bipartisan. Alongside of this began the very sharp rise in costs of elections, which drives the political parties even deeper than before into the pockets of the corporate sector. A couple of years later started a different process, which has been described particularly by Tom Ferguson, who's going to be here Monday. He probably will talk about it, so I won't much. But parties dissolved, essentially. It used to be that if a person in Congress hoped for a position of, let's say, a committee chair or something, some position of responsibility, you got it mainly through seniority and service. Within a couple of years, you started having to put money into the party coffers in order to get ahead. That just drove the whole system even deeper into the pockets of the corporate sector, increasingly the financial sector. A tremendous concentration of wealth, mainly in literally the top one-tenth of 1% of the population. Meanwhile, for the general population, it began and opened a period of pretty much stagnation or even decline for the majority. People got by, but by pretty artificial means, borrowing, so a lot of debt, longer working hours, but pretty soon much higher than in other industrial countries, even past Japan, long past Europe. Can't hear me? Sorry. Still, how about that? So there was a period of stagnation and decline for the majority that continued alongside a very sharp concentration of wealth. The political system began to dissolve. There's always been a gap between public policy and the public will, but it just grew kind of astronomically. You can see it right now, in fact, can't hear me? I don't know what to do about it. These things are in my mouth. I'll just keep going. You can make it.
It's on the live stream.
What?
It's recorded
on the live
stream.
Oh, okay. Just take a look at what's...
Get it on YouTube.
Okay. Just take a look at what's happening right now. The big topic in Washington, everyone concentrates on, is the deficit. For the public, correctly, the deficit is not regarded as much of an issue, and it isn't really much of an issue. The issue is joblessness, not a deficit. There's a deficit commission, but there's no joblessness commission. As far as the deficit is concerned, you want to pay attention to it. The public has opinions. Take a look at the polls. Overwhelmingly support higher taxes on the wealthy, which have declined sharply during this stagnation period of decline. Higher taxes on the wealthy and preserve the limited social benefits. The outcome of the deficit commission is probably going to be the opposite. Either they'll reach an agreement, which will be the opposite of what the public wants, or else it goes into a kind of automatic procedure, which is going to have those effects. Actually, that's something that has to be done very quickly. Deficit commission is going to come up with its decision in a couple of weeks. The Occupy movements could provide a mass base for trying to avert what amounts to a dagger pointed at the heart of the country. It could have very negative effects. It's an immediate task. Well, without going on in the details, what's being played out for the last 30 years is actually a kind of a nightmare that was anticipated by the classical economists. You take, say, Adam Smith, bother to read Wealth of Nations, he considered the possibility that the merchants and manufacturers in England might decide to do their business abroad, invest abroad, and import from abroad. He said they would profit, but England would be harmed. However, he went on to say that they would prefer to, merchants, manufacturers would prefer to operate in their own country, what's sometimes called a home bias. So as if by an invisible hand, England would be saved the ravages of what's now called neoliberal globalization. That's a pretty hard passage to miss. In his classic Wealth of Nations, that's the only occurrence of the phrase invisible hand. Maybe England would be saved from neoliberal globalization by an invisible hand. The other great classical economist, David Ricardo, recognized the same thing and hoped that it wouldn't happen, kind of a sentimental hope. And it didn't for a long time, but now it's happening. The last 30 years, that's exactly what's been underway. for the general population, you know, the 99% in the imagery of the Occupy movements, it's been pretty harsh, and it could get worse. Now, this could be a period of irreversible decline. For the 1%, even more, 0.1%, it's just fine. They're at the top of the richer than ever, more powerful than ever, controlling the political system, disregarding the public. And if it can continue, sure, why not? Just what Smith and Ricardo warned about. So, for example, take, say, Citigroup, one of the most corrupt of the major kind of investment banking corporations, repeatedly bailed out by the taxpayer over and over again, starting in the early Reagan years. Now, once again, I won't run through the corruption. You probably know about it, but it's pretty astonishing. A couple of years ago, they came out with a brochure for investors. They urged investors to put their money in what they call the plutonomy index. They said the world is dividing into a plutonomy, you know, the rich, those who buy luxury goods and so on, and that's where the action is. They said their plutonomy index is way outperforming the stock market, so put your money into it, and as for the rest, we set them adrift. We don't really care about them. We don't need them. They have to be around to provide a powerful state which will protect us and bail us out when we get into trouble, but other than that, they essentially have no function. They're sometimes called these days the precariat, people who live a precarious existence at the periphery of society. It's not the periphery anymore. It's becoming a very substantial part of the society in the United States and indeed elsewhere. This is considered a good thing. So, for example, Alan Greenspan, at the time when Alan Greenspan was still, you know, St. Alan, hailed by the economics profession as one of the greatest economists of all time. This was before the crash for which he was substantially responsible. He was testifying to Congress in the Clinton years, explaining the wonders of the great economy that he was supervising. And he said a lot of the success of this economy, he said, is based on substantially on what he called growing worker insecurity.
Yeah, let's do it this way.
Well, Greenspan testified that the very successful economy he was supervising, which has the properties I described, was based substantially on growing worker insecurity. If working people are insecure, if they're part of what we now call the precariat, living precarious existences, they're not going to make demands, they're not going to try to get wages, they won't get benefits. We can kick them out if we don't like them. And that's good for the health of the economy. That's what's called a healthy economy, technically. And he was very highly praised for this, greatly admired. Well, now the world is indeed splitting into a plutonomy and a precariat, again, in the imagery of the Occupy movements, the 1% and the 99%, you know, not literal numbers, but the right picture. And the plutonomy is where the action is. Well, it could continue like this. And if it does continue, this historic reversal that began in the 1970s could become irreversible. That's where we're heading. And the Occupy movements are the first real major popular reaction, which could avert this. But as I said, it's going to be necessary to face the fact that it's a long, hard struggle. You don't win victories tomorrow. Have to go on, have to form structures that will be sustained, will go on through hard times, and can win major victories. Now, there are a lot of things that can be done. I mentioned before that in the 1930s, one of the most effective actions was a sit-down strike. The And the reason is very simple. That's just a step before takeover of the industry. Well, through the 70s, as the decline was setting in, there were some very important events that took place. One was in the late 70s, 1977. U.S. Steel decided to close one of its major facilities, Youngstown, Ohio, and instead of just walking away, the workforce and the community decided to get together and buy it from U.S. Steel and hand it over to the workforce to run and turn it into a worker-owned, worker-management facility. They didn't win, but with enough popular support, they could have won. And it was a partial victory. It's a topic that Igor Alperovitz particularly has discussed in detail. It was a partial victory because even though they lost, it set off other efforts. And now throughout Ohio, and in fact in other places, there's a scattering of hundreds, maybe thousands of sometimes not so small worker-owned or at least partially worker-owned industries which could become worker-managed. And that's the basis for a real revolution. That's how it takes place. It's happening here too. Just in one of the suburbs of Boston about a year ago, something similar happened. A multinational decided to close down a profitable, functioning manufacturing facility, doing some high-tech manufacturing, not profitable enough for them. The workforce and the union offered to buy it and take it over and run it themselves. And the multinational decided to close it down instead, probably for reasons of class consciousness. I don't think they want things like this to happen. If there had been enough popular support, if there'd been something like this movement and it could have gotten involved, they might have succeeded. And there are other things going on like that. In fact, some of them are major. So not long ago, Obama took over the auto industry. It's basically owned by the public. And there were a number of things that could have been done. One was what was done. Reconstitute it so that it can be handed back to the ownership or very similar ownership and continue on its traditional path. The other possibility was to hand it over to the workforce, which owned it anyway, turn it into worker-owned, worker-managed, major industrial system that's a big part of the economy, and have it produce things that people need. And there's a lot that we need. We all know, or should know, that the U.S. is extremely backward globally in high-tech and high-speed transportation. It's very serious. It not only affects people's lives, it affects the economy. It's a very serious business. Just had a personal story. I happened to be giving talks in France a couple months ago and ended up in southern France. I had to take a train from Avignon, southern France, to the De Gaulle Airport in Paris. And it took 2 hours. It's the same distance as Washington to Boston. I don't know if you've taken that train, but it's about what it was, you know, 60 years ago when my wife and I first took it. And it's a scandal, you know. But it could be done. They had the capacity to do it, the skilled workforce. It would have taken a little support, popular support, and that could have made a major change in the economy. And just to make it more surreal, while this option was being avoided, the Obama administration was sending its transportation secretary to Spain to get contracts for developing high-speed rail for the United States, which could have been done right in the Rust Belt, which is being closed down. There's no economic reasons why this can't happen. These are class reasons and reflect the lack of popular political mobilization. Well, things like this continue. I see. You can see why I'm not a public speaker. Okay. Well, I'll just like that. A little late, but I think I've probably talked enough anyway. So let me just say that, and I'd like to make more sense to turn this over to public discussion, but I kept to domestic issues, and these are by no means the only ones. You'll know that. There's very dangerous developments in the international arena, including two of them, which are kind of a shadow that hangs over almost everything we discuss. There are, for the first time in human history, real threats to decent survival of the species. There are two. One has been hanging around for since 1945, and it's kind of a miracle of escape. That's the threat of nuclear war, nuclear weapons. And though it isn't being much discussed, that threat is in fact being escalated by policies of this administration and its allies. And that something has to be done about that, or we're in real trouble. The other, of course, is environmental catastrophe. The world is, frankly, every country in the world is taking at least halting steps towards trying to do something about it. The U.S. is also taking steps, namely to accelerate the threat. The U.S. is the only country, major country, that's not only not doing something constructive, but is, you know, so it's not climbing on the train, it's pulling it backwards. Congress right now is dismantling legislation instituted by the Nixon administration, really the last liberal president in the United States, literally, and it shows you what's been going on. They're dismantling the limited measures of the Nixon administration to try to do something about what's a growing, emerging catastrophe. And this is connected with a huge propaganda system, perfectly openly declared by the business world, to try to convince people that it's all just a liberal hoax. Why pay attention to these scientists? And we're really regressing back to the medieval period. That's not a joke. Now, if that's happening in the most powerful, richest country in history, this catastrophe isn't going to be averted, and everything else we're talking about won't matter in a generation or two. Well, all that's going on right now. Something has to be done about it very soon, very in a dedicated, sustained way. It's not going to be easy to proceed. There are going to be barriers, difficulties, hardships, failures. It's inevitable. But unless the process that's taking place here, elsewhere in the country and around the world, unless that continues to grow and becomes a kind of a major force in the social and political world, the chances for a decent future are not very high.
And now here's the indigenous perspective of the Occupy movement, courtesy of Indigenous Politics.
I'm with Indigenous Politics from Native New England and beyond, and I'm doing a special episode on Native engagement with the Wall Street protests all across the country. But it started here on Lenape territory, and I wanted to know what brings you to the protest to demonstrate and your presence here, if you could speak to the issues.
My name is Charles Whalen. As you said, the occupation of Wall Street actually began over 500 years ago, and we are still under foreign occupation. What I see looking around me is a bunch of Caucasians who want solidarity in what they're trying to do, who have never lent solidarity to Native organizations, Native nations, to people of color and their organizations. And the things that they're protesting, we have been protesting. The things that they want publicized, we have publicized. And like I said, because these are Caucasians who are finally being affected the way that indigenous peoples and peoples of colors have been affected, they want solidarity. Now, isn't that some BS? I'm gonna keep it clean. I'm not going to curse. I'm not actually protesting anything. I just came down here to see all these people. What I see is a bunch of Caucasian homeless people who finally have a safe place to sleep, and that's a good thing because they're surrounded by people. I see these homeless people that have food because they've got distribution for food here. You got clothing, this is what I see. I see middle-class kids coming in from the suburbs to protest for their future, a future that natives and people of color can only hope to have. Education, graduate degrees, a debt so that they could go to college and work to pay off this debt that many of us as natives and people of color will never have, because we're the type of people who celebrate when we even have a family member go to college. These people take it for granted, and when they finally get impacted, they want solidarity. Hey, where is the solidarity for our native nations and people of color who have had these struggles since day one? Occupying Wall Street, hey, we're still surrounded by these foreign, I guess you would say domestic-born foreigners, because that's what they are. All right, where are the treaty issues being addressed? At the Indigenous Forum of the United Nations? Well, to a certain extent. We are native, we're still alive, we are here, and these people should recognize that we are here and give solidarity to us. And anything and everything that they do concerning natives and people of color, anything concerning this country, they should put us in the front as representatives of our people.